listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, our weekly conversation with the editor-in-chief of the Consortium News website, Joe Loria. At the front page of Consortium News this week, John McCain, The View from the Middle East, an online vigil in defense of Julian Assange, the unlikely force behind U.S. prison reform, the Trump administration's spoiler foreign policy, VIPs tell media, support for Brennan is not unanimous, and back in the great game, the revenge of Eurasian land powers. Okay, Joe, so we're going to do another perusal of the front page of consortiumnews.com. Let you take us on a tour.
Well, thank you, Don. It's always a good laugh and also a serious look.
Yeah.
And what we're reporting, I just want to say also that we've begun podcasts on Libsyn, and your these broadcasts that we do will be included on those podcasts so people can go back and
excellent.
Listen to them there. We'll soon be on iTunes and Spotify, et cetera, et cetera.
Beautiful.
So the story we have up top right now is by Asad Abdul Khalil, known better to most people as the Angry Arab. He runs the Arab Angry blog, which I recommend to everyone.
Yep.
If you really want to go deep into the Middle East, maybe too deep for a lot of Westerners, but he's a Lebanese professor out in California, where I am right now, speaking to you from Oakland. Hmm. So this is the last piece. We've only
Well, this isn't the first piece about McCain either. We had Max
Blumenthal, which was an excellent piece that got over 54,000 page views, probably a record for Consortium News. That was an excellent obit that Max Blumenthal wrote. This one focuses only on McCain's activism in the Middle East. So from a Middle East perspective, how is McCain seen? And Assad begins his piece with a very interesting little anecdote here. You've all heard how McCain was praised for the answer he gave to a woman during the campaign when she was complaining about Obama being an Arab. And McCain said, "No, ma'am, he's not an Arab. he's a decent family man.
Right.
And apparently that was played over and over again. I did not watch any, not one second of McCain festivities, except out of the corner of my eye in a restaurant. I think I might have mentioned on our last show, but I did not watch it. But I believe Assad when he tells me that they mentioned that over and over again. Yes, he's not an Arab. He's a decent family man. In other words, Arabs cannot be decent family men, but that's not the way it was seen here. But Assad is pointing out that's the way Arabs are, clearly. So Mr. McCain or Senator McCain was clearly no friend of Arabs and Muslims, except those who could help extend his agenda and America's agenda in the Middle East, such as bloody dictators and would-be regime changers like Ahmed Chalabi in Iraq, and jihadist extremists in Syria, would-be overthrowers of the Syrian government in Damascus. So clearly, he was driven by politics, by geopolitics. He was, in my opinion, and as Assad ends the piece, a face of American empire without any question. This is why I think he's given the attention he's gotten right now, the deification that he's gone through, not because of who John McCain was, but because of who he represented, what he represented, what he symbolized, which is America's power in the world and its continuing interest in maintaining and extending that power and containing the only threats really to that power, which are China and Russia combining together, and that Eurasia being there again of the world in terms of controlling the world, which could segue us into the piece by Pepe Escobar, unless you have some questions about McCain, Don.
No, I'm all McCained out.
You're McCained out as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just want to say one other thing. Excuse me, if readers go to that, to our piece, which has been published yesterday, John McCain, The View from the Middle East, the photographs that I chose three photographs for this article. There are no humans in them except a bunch of refugees leaving the bombed-out Mosul, a mosque in Mosul. The second picture is the destruction of Italian tanks that belonged to the Gaddafi government during the March 2011 NATO intervention. And the last one is a scene of destruction in homes. So I just showed the results of John McCain's efforts in the Middle East, just three pictures of destroyed places.
Iraq,
that he left
Syria
behind. This is the legacy of John McCain.
That's right. Absolutely.
That, no know, more
dead people also in each of these places. I mean, these, you're showing ruins, things that were blown up. And, of course, there were, you know, people that were murdered when this happened also, all over the place. Still happening, too.
Of course. And still, you know, not wholly, but he was a major, I mean, he made this effort to go overseas and to meet with these guys and drum up support. It was almost like his own foreign policy. You talk about the Logan Act. Was he authorized to do all of this stuff? Probably, but McCain, no pictures of humans, no pictures of George W. Bush giving a cough drop to Michelle Obama on my story.
Right.
Only destruction in the Middle East.
It's reality.
Next story we had was let's see, what is the next story, Don?
Next story, in terms of sequence, it's Julian Assange-a-thon over the weekend.
Correct. Yes, I took part in an 11-hour, so did Don DeBar, by the way, 11-hour marathon, actually shorter than the 50-hour one last week. This is a monthly event that's held online, organized by Susie Dawson, incredibly talented and tireless activist.
Yeah, amazing.
She needed some breather because she's also working to organize the on-the-ground street demonstrations, which took place in various places around the world the following day, Sunday. This broadcast was Saturday. Of course, I was to take it over completely, but Susie still did most of the work, I have to say.
Right.
Although maybe I relieved her a little bit. It was my first time. So we're going to try to next time give her even less time involved. But there were a couple of just technical hiccups. I think I'm going to have to anchor those transitions. What we did was have each person get interviewed for a half hour, and then they interviewed the next person. And I also, at the end, was able to engineer Dan Ellsberg to come on the line, and I did a straight interview with him for 35 minutes, which the whole thing is right now on the site, the whole 11 hours, but I've just gotten this morning the edited version of just my interview with Dan Ellsberg, and I'm going to post that this afternoon, hopefully, or tomorrow. And that is really worth watching because Dan was terrific. He's 88 years old, and he's speaking only as sharply as he ever has.
Yes, he is.
And very strongly in defense, of course, of Julian Assange, of Chelsea Manning. He complained about her not getting the visa to Australia. It's really worth watching this interview with Dan. He does almost all the talking, so you don't have to listen to me. It's Dan Ellsberg, and I really highly recommend that. Look for that later in today, as the whole 11 hours is still up there.
Right. And again, that's at consortiumnews.com.
Correct. Cool. What else are we talking about today, Don?
Let's see. We've got Kiriakou, John Kiriakou's piece about the unlikely force behind U.S. prison reform.
Correct. That's an interesting piece. John is writing a column for us now, and we're happy about that. John is looking at something that I wasn't aware of, frankly, which is the role of the Christian right in prison reform. It might be the only right thing that the Christian right does, as far as I could tell. They want to reduce some of the absolute abuses that take place in our system in terms of the vast numbers of people in prison, more than anywhere else, of course, in the world. And he points to Chuck Colson, who was a hatchet man for Nixon during the Watergate days, becoming, I guess, born again while he was in prison. And he came out, of course, he was in prison. I guess it's like that story of the conservatives, the liberal who gets mugged or something.
Right.
So he's a conservative who goes to jail and becomes a liberal when it comes to prison issues.
Yep.
Just the opposite. So he was in jail. He didn't like it. So he wanted to – he's made this a life issue of him, this prison fellowship that he started. So, but it now extends to the Trump administration, which – has got the Christian right support, which is clearly Republican, even though the Christian right being behind that and somehow supporting Trump, even though he's not a very holy man by his behavior, it seems like. But the Christian right and the presidency are combining, and part of the reason is because of Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, whose father spent time in jail for financial crimes back in 2004. He spent 24 months. I think he got out in 14 months. He was sentenced to 24 months. So Jared Kushner has an interest in prison reform because his dad was in jail. So this is the way it seems to go. And they are working on a bill, and Trump supports it, that would lower lifetime mandatory sentences on drug issues to only 25 years, reduce 20-year mandatory minimum sentences for offenders up to 15 years. The whole list of the things that are up there are on this on our side in the story, the point being that it's the Christian right and the Republicans who are pushing more for prison reform right now than liberals, which is quite interesting.
Yeah. You know, I saw a statistic go by last week, and I didn't have a chance to fact check it. But even if it was within two orders of magnitude, it was quite impressive that something like 50 new felonies are created every year under the federal code. In other words, 50 things that were not a felony before are this year a felony as a result of, you know, the hard work of our friends and neighbors in the Congress. And, you know, the implications of that, of course, are obvious. And it certainly does help to illuminate the pie charts and the slopes of the curves that demonstrate prison populations over the last 20, 30 years, for example.
You read that in the first paragraph of John Kiriakou's story that we're discussing. He points out that Congress creates 50 new crimes every year. He says that's 500 things that were legal a decade ago that are now felonies.
Right.
No wonder the prisons are full, John says.
Yeah, right. Yep.
It's an extraordinary thing. I wasn't aware of that. I had no idea. So that's John's story on Consortium News, which tells you a different angle. We're mostly focused on foreign policy. I'm glad to have a domestic story come up.
Yep. Well, let's go to foreign policy now, because the next story is the Trump administration's spoiler foreign policy, and that's Patrick Lawrence's article.
That's correct. Patrick looks at Trump's foreign policy. He asks whether there is such a thing as a Trump foreign policy, because one can't really tell who's running it, whether it's Trump, whether it's Minders, who among his Minders, what's going on behind the scenes. We only see the results of this. He says one thing, another thing happens. You remember, I think it was in Ohio some months ago, he announced that we're pulling out of Syria. Everybody got excited.
Right.
The United States is still in Syria. The special forces, the 2,000 or 3,000 or 4,000, whatever they are, still there in oil areas in eastern Syria. What's the point of Trump formulating what seems like rational policy once in a while, and then it's not implemented? What's going on? We can't tell. That probably won't be maybe Bob Woodward is coming out with an inside account of what's going on in the White House. He might, although I don't trust him necessarily. I usually give the establishment point of view all the time. However, there might be nuggets in there about what goes on behind the scenes in terms of who makes the actual decisions or who makes what people are involved in different decisions, et cetera. So the point, the result is, however, again, this points to Pepe's article, which we're going to probably talk about less, about geopolitics, is that the U.S. is behind the eight ball. It is not doing very well in terms of it's trying to control Eurasia, China, and Russia. Of course, it's still surrounding both, and it is still a menace to both those. And certainly it has not lost this geostrategic battle, but it is losing it, and losing it on the periphery, like in Syria. This is a loss. Libya was a disaster. Iraq, a disaster. So where the United States has been acting recently has really led to mostly defeats. And what is this add up to in Patrick Lawrence's estimation is that the U.S. has now been reduced not to the major global power running things, but as a spoiler, it's trying to stop Russia and China from consolidating their alliance, which was prompted very much by the Obama administration and their sanctions against Russia. They drew China and Russia even closer to together on economic, both economic and military even alliances. So the U.S. is reduced to a spoiler. So that would maybe explain why Syrian special forces, the U.S. special forces, remain in Syria to just muddy up things, screw things up, slow things down. It's not in the driver's seat anymore, but it's in the passenger seat telling the driver to make a wrong turn. Right. This is what the U.S. foreign policy is what Patrick is saying.
Yeah, and in addition to that, you have the navigator, what they call, you know, the Google Maps thing, whatever, screaming at you to take a different turn while the passenger is telling you to make this turn. The guy in the back seat is telling you, no, it's that, go that way. Because we're looking at Nikki Haley saying one thing, you know, Pump, all these various people. You got the Secretary of State and you've got Bolton and all these other characters. Each one has a characterization of what a particular policy is. And then when Trump's finally heard from, very often, none of them had it right.
Recalculating. Isn't that what the GPS says when you've made a wrong turn?
That's right. Recalculating.
That could have been the title of this piece, just recalculating, that's what American foreign policy seems to be right now. It is a very interesting and good read from Patrick Lawrence. He's also writing a regular column for us right now. So we're getting down to some good writers here. Pepe Escobar, Max Blumenthal, John Kiriakou, Patrick Lawrence, all writing regularly for ConsortiumNews.com. Really, for the first time, all of them are new writers for Consortium. And take it away, Don. What's next?
Some good stuff. I think we were going to, let's see. Well, the next thing on the page is the VIPs, but I think we're going to go to Pepe, right? We had Pepe.
Yeah, the VIP was interesting because it's about John Brennan's security clearance being lifted. That happened a couple of weeks ago. But the Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, begun by Bill Binney, former NSA technical director, and Ray McGovern, former CIA officer, used to brief George H.W. Bush and Ronald Reagan in the morning CIA briefings, was started about 15 years ago, just before the invasion of Iraq, pointing out that this was a mistake and that there was no intelligence proving WMD, and they were proven right, of course, and they've been proven right many, many times after. This is, I think, the first one in 15 years that is not addressed to the president, but is addressed in the vein of Ray's briefings to the president. This one is addressed to the media.
Right.
And it's saying essentially that this, and this was immediately apparent to me, and I'm sure lots of people, when they used this line that lifting John Brennan's security clearance was a violation of his First Amendment rights. Well, how could that possibly be? Nobody's telling him he can't talk.
Right.
They're saying he doesn't have access to classified information anymore, and then talk.
Right.
So maybe the networks don't want him anymore because he won't have that access. I don't know if that's true, but if it is, that's not. That's the decision of the private networks, and they're allowed to suppress.
Right.
That's what they're telling us, right?
So by the way,
they're telling us that Facebook and Google can censor us because they're private companies at the behest of the government, who browbeat them in open testimony in Congress to do so. Now if Brennan is going to lose his gig on MSNBC because, well, that's tough turkey, you know?
Well, what we're talking about is classified information. And so what they're saying is, in essence, what we've been doing is paying Brennan for access to classified information. I'm not expert in the federal code, but that sounds like a felony or several felonies.
Well, I don't know whether he's reviewed. I don't watch him on MSNBC or any of these former intelligence people, so I don't know what he's actually saying. I haven't heard. I usually read about it when they say something of significance, but I think the issue is that he can't leak anymore to the New York Times and the Washington Post. And from the moment Trump got in, we started getting these unbelievable leaks that you wouldn't find out usually till 20 years later what happened in a meeting between Lavrov, the foreign minister of Russia, and Trump in the Oval Office a couple of weeks after Trump was inaugurated. That was the next day in the New York Times, everything that was said. So somebody in that room, you know, has clearance, clearly, and went down the chain either directly or indirectly, got to people probably like Brennan and Clapper, et cetera, who became these unnamed sources for the New York Times, and that's what we got. The whole Russiagate story has been fed almost largely, almost all, on these unnamed sources, at least until these Mueller indictments, which have no evidence. It's just they're just accusations, and they could be based a lot on these intelligence statements that could be made up. We don't know because they're unnamed, but the access that Clapper and that Brennan had to this could allow them to leak it to the New York Times and the Washington Post, which I think happened somehow in that, let's just example that Lavrov meeting. So that will cease. I think that is what Trump's motivation was, and he probably should have done it earlier, but it is not a restriction of Brennan's freedom of speech.
Right.
It's just extraordinary that they would even try to think that. So Brennan, so this Vips memo was pointedly addressed to the media and also said, hey, not everybody in the intelligence community, you know, love John Brennan, and it goes on to describe his various misdeeds, even crimes, where he lied to Congress about not spying on the Senate during the torture memo investigation, about how when he was station chief in Riyadh that he immediately blamed Hezbollah for the Khobar Towers bombings, even though there was never any evidence for that. It was Al-Qaeda, which is Sunni, which is linked to Saudi Arabia, of course.
Right.
You know, this memo is, if you want another rundown of everything evil about John Brennan and why he should never have kept his security clearance. And don't forget, this is signed by about a dozen or more people who all had security clearances in their career. So they know what it is. And the responsibility, they point out, is a restriction on their freedom of speech. And they've agreed to that. They're going to learn something they can't talk about, even in some cases to their own spouses, and including for the rest of their lives. So John Brennan doesn't deserve that. Clearance is what these professional intelligence, former intelligence officials are saying, and it's a very powerful memo.
I mean, Senator Mark Udall, in December of 2014, so it's not ancient history, people that are involved in this now should remember it, talks about when, you know, Brennan's time at the CIA, that they lied to its overseers and the public, meaning Congress and the public, destroyed and tried to hold back evidence, spied on the Senate, made false charges against Senate staff, and lied about torture and the results of torture. That's, you know,
for starters.
That's one line in a long resume of, you know, kindred actions. So.
Yeah. No reason to shed any tears over Brennan losing a security clearance.
Right.
That's coming from definitely a non-Trump supporter, but I'm telling you that Brennan is bad news. This memo makes it clear why.
All right, so we can go now to Pepe. I know this is a kind of a coup, getting him to sign up on consortiumnews.com.
Very thrilled to have Pepe Escobar, who I've been reading for years, as many of your listeners have. I really like Pepe. I think he's great on TV. He's very funny, and he's very incisive, and he's brilliant, usually on geopolitical issues, which he is in his premier piece for Consortium News. It's called Back in the Great Game, The Revenge of Eurasian Land Powers. And here's Pepe again and coining some great lines here, which one of them is, it's now China's new Silk Roads versus America's Our Way or the Highway. I mean, that really
perfect.
Encapsulates the whole thing
it does,
that's the whole story, because it's about China and Russia integrating economically
to the point where they are creating an integrated economic unit, and they want to bring Western Europe into that. That is the ultimate nightmare of Kissinger and Brzezinski, as Pepe points out, to keep Europe out of the Eurasian integration, which for the Europeans' interests would be much greater than having the status quo, which is sanctions against Russia, which are particularly hurting German business. They've never been for it. The German businessmen were against it from the start. Merkel is torn between them, German interests, and what America's telling him her to do. NATO, what is NATO telling, which is the U.S. telling her to do. So if China, if there were ever a Berlin, Moscow, Beijing axis, that would be, of course, heart attacks up and down to Pennsylvania Avenue and all around the Beltway. And this is what Pepe is talking about. Of course, he goes into his theories about Mackinder and Spikeman, and these are the root of the geostrategic strategy, which is to contain and encircle Eurasia, which includes, of course, Western Europe, Eastern Europe, and all of Asia, from Japan to from Tokyo to Lisbon, or from Vladivostok to Madrid. We've got a long, that is the major landmass on Earth.
Right.
And the U.S. is using sea power to try to control it, and Pepe is arguing about how the importance of land troops as well in this, in the in creation of this Silk Road, which it's going to take years and years to build, but China is building while the United States is destroying. Another great line of Pepe Escobar's. Yes, China, does China get advantages from this? No doubt about that. Most of them being that they send Chinese workers to Africa to work on these infrastructure projects and don't hire perhaps as many Africans as they should. But they're leaving behind infrastructure in Africa. They are ultimately going to improve the economies of all these countries in Africa and Latin America. And they are, you might call it economic colonialism. It is not invading with bombs and troops like the United States is still doing. It's so 20th century done. To invade Iraq with hundreds of thousands of troops and occupy a country. And then to have John Kerry say after the annexation of Crimea, bloodless annexation of Korea following a referendum, countries don't invade other countries in the 21st century.
Yeah, right.
When he voted for the invasion of Iraq, after he voted against it or for it or whatever he did, he was in favor of that invasion, yeah. And he did, the audacity, I just pull that out as an example, the audacity of American thinking to say that Russia and China are the imperialists here.
Right.
When they are pursuing a model, multilateral model that the world needs in order to survive, and the U.S. is doing everything to undermine it. Why? Because its supremacy at the end of World War II, when it was left with a world empire, a destroyed world except for the U.S., which had rebuilt itself through its war industry, stood across the whole world in total control. It had ships everywhere and bases. It was not even by design necessarily, but they were left with a world empire. They've been trying to maintain that ever since, using everybody. And their brother who opposes the U.S. is Hitler, still using World War II terminology. And now here is Russia and China trying to integrate peacefully with the world. The U.S. cannot have it. So this is a great, great piece by Pepe in explaining that dynamic.
And if anyone thinks that he's being, you know, he's exaggerating or whatever, it's an interesting piece of testimony that was given to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee 2 weeks ago, August 21st. 2018, by Assistant Secretary of State for European and Eurasian Affairs, A. West Mitchell. And I'm just going to pull these two sentences out of the opening paragraphs. The first is, Russia and China are serious competitors that are building up the material and ideological wherewithal to contest U.S. primacy and leadership in the 21st century. It says here that it continues to be the foremost national security interest of the United States to prevent the domination of the Eurasian landmass by hostile powers. In other words, it's our policy to prevent Russia and China from dominating the land that they're on.
Exactly. Hostile powers on their own land.
Right.
So they're hostile to us in their own country. Isn't right. that amazing?
How dare they?
Just the way, I mean, come on. You know, the implication, and that's a perfect quote, it goes exactly to the heart of Pepe's theory, but the implication there is, again, that the U.S. has the rights to this landmass, and it does it, and that China and Russia are hostile because they are trying to take over the world. Look at the bases that they have around the world. China has one overseas military base in Eritrea, I believe, or in Djibouti. I think it's in Djibouti. One overseas military base. And so are they trying to take over the world? Russia has maybe about eight, and most of those are in the former Soviet countries in Central Asia that they were allowed to keep there. So they didn't actually extend it. They just didn't leave. These are the two powers that are trying to dominate the world. They are couching. This is classic projection, Don, right, where the U.S. imperialism is projected onto the people who are trying to block American imperialism, that they're the imperialists, not us. We're spreading democracy, which brings us back to John McCain and Assad Gabulukhalil's piece, where he talks about all this nonsense that of McCain being a democracy spreader, where the head of Human Rights Watch apparently in Washington called him that, when of course he was just using that language like any conquistador does. We're coming to bring freedom, and we're going to kill you if you stand in our way. This is his idea of freedom. Right. So this is the world we're living in right now, and the pieces we have up there will help readers understand it just a little bit better, and I appreciate you having me on to talk about that.
And I'm glad to have you. I guess we'll close with Pepe's closing. You know, he talks about the horizon for the Belt and Road Initiative is 2039, and that it's really starting to get installed next year. So we're talking about a 20-year period that's just about to begin. It's been 5 years since it was announced by Xi Jinping, and it took that long for there to be any kind of a response from the U.S. And this is taking place, as you mentioned, China's offering an alternative within the context, which we've discussed here a number of times, where China is offering the world places like Africa, Latin America, win-win as a way of engagement. In other words, things that will benefit both sides because they see having enriching their partners as a way of enriching themselves. More, if you're rich enough to buy more stuff from me, you'll buy more stuff from me. The U.S. model being, give me your stuff. Oh, by the way, carry it over to my boat and leaving nothing behind that. And so hopefully we're seeing the dawn of a new day, the springing, and we're going to see you again next week and see what you got popping on page one of consortiumnews.com.
Well, thank you very much, Don.
Joe,
I hope that new day comes. Bye-bye.
Yeah, take care. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. From Syria to the European Union, from Iran to Turkey and North Korea, what kind of world order is the Trump administration striving to create? Is there a method to all this madness? Clearly, the old world order is under threat and intensifying. What will replace it? Crosstalking Trump's trajectory, I'm joined by my guest, Joshua Landis and Norman. He's the director of the Center of Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. In London, we have Abdel Bari Atwan. He is an expert on political Islam and author of Islamic State, the Digital Caliphate. And in Oxford, we cross to Mark Allman. He is the director of the Crisis Research Institute. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Joshua, let me go to you first here and refresh your memory of two pieces of news that have come out. First, a tweet from the President of the United States regarding Idlib in Syria. The Russians and the Iranians will be making a grave humanitarian mistake to take part in this potential human tragedy. Went on to say hundreds of thousands of people could be killed. And then we have, through the good services of David Ignatius over at the Washington Post, he talked to a high-level administration official. I tend to think the first initial of the last name is B. I'll let you guys guess. He said to the Washington Post, right now, our job is to create quagmires until we get what we want in Syria. Joshua, it seems to me that the U.S. is really forcing an issue here. We have the United Nations coming out of the 70 or so so-called rebels or fighters or whatever you want to say in Idlib. Up to 10,000 or more are directly identified as al-Qaeda or something like that. So what in the world is Donald Trump talking about? Go ahead, Joshua.
Well, if we look at the real words that Donald Trump used in his tweet, it's very ambiguous. He says, there could be hundreds of thousands killed, and you shouldn't do that. So in other words, if you killed less than hundreds of thousands, perhaps America would overlook it. It's ambiguous talk. It's not clear that this isn't part of a war of words. But we saw in Deraa, the last province that was overrun by Syrian government, that Syrian government retook from rebels, the United States had threatened that very serious consequences, and it did nothing. So it's not clear to me, but what is clear is that the United States does seek to create a quagmire in Syria. And that has been the plan to stay there in the long distance, which is to deny the Syrian government the oil wealth that's in the north of the country, agriculture, water. Those are the three main things the United States can deny Damascus and Russia and Iran in rebuilding Syria by remaining there. And keeping Idlib province, of course, is another thing to destabilize Syria until regime change, theoretically, which is what the United States has recommitted itself to. Yeah.
Abdel, let me go to you in London. I agree with what Joshua said, but there's a slight difference here. In the tweet, it mentioned Russia and Iran, which is also a signal being sent to them. Of course, both Russia and Iran have been legally invited to help protect the sovereignty or retake the sovereignty of Syria here. And these look like fighting words here. I do think we all remember when the catastrophic humanitarian crisis of the Damascus government retaking Aleppo. Remember all that? And then, well, they all kind of forgot it. But it's the same rhetoric all over again. Go ahead in London.
I believe this demonization of Iran and Russia is deliberately used by President Trump in order to mobilize people behind himself and behind his future plan, maybe to indulge in a confrontation with Russia and the Syrian army on Idlib in particular. You know, I'm really shocked with this tweet, because what is the alternative? You know, President Trump never said, okay, you know, there will be 100,000 will be killed. We haven't seen these kind of numbers when the Syrian army liberated Deraa or liberated east of Aleppo. So, but what is his alternative? To leave Aleppo, to leave Idlib under the grips of terrorist organization there. There are tens of thousands of them there, and they are armed to their teeth. So what is his alternative? What is the alternative for the Russian government, for the Syrian government? To leave Idlib as a hot nest for terrorist organization? We heard President Trump saying a lot of times that we want to root out terrorists from Syria. This is the main object of the American intervention there. Why he changed his mind?
Yeah, well, that, you know, let me go to Mark here. I mean, it's all over social media comparing Donald Trump's tweets from before he was president and today when it comes to Syria, and it is obviously a flip-flop here. The point is here, Mark, is that the Syrian government has made it very clear that it is going to liberate these areas, and it has been slowly but surely doing it, and with success here. That's what the United States and its allies don't want. They don't want a success. They don't want stability. And as the source that the Washington Post talked to, just keep making quagmires. Whose interests are quagmires, in your opinion? Go ahead, Mark.
Well, I think people often think something's in their interest and it turns out to be wrong.
Yep.
It seems to me that in practice, by sustaining the insurrection in Syria against Assad, the United States, its allies, the Gulf states and so on, actually have drawn in what they feared. They drew in Hezbollah, then Iran and Russia. And in fact, since the Western states are not prepared to confront directly the military power that is now deployed in Syria, what they're doing is in fact bringing about what they feared, that is the creation, if you like, of a advance guard of the Iranian Islamic Republic to the West, and for that matter, a reassertion of Russian influence in the Middle East. Let's look at the role, for instance, of Israel. The Israeli Prime Minister, unlike West European or European Union leaders of government, has been quite happy to visit Moscow and to talk to Putin on a regular basis, because he's recognizing the realities on the ground and trying to find a solution which is in his interest, in Israel's interest as he sees them, but also recognizing that in many ways the promotion of the rebellion against Assad has backfired and risks backfiring badly for Israel because of the drawing in of Iran.
Okay, Joshua, I mean, this is where I always go back to. My default position when it comes to Syria, unfortunately, is Iran, because you can see that during the campaign, Trump's campaign, and afterwards, he had a great sense of ambivalence when it comes to Syria. Yes, he's bombed it twice under false pretenses, at least that's what the public, there's no evidence of the real reason, these chemical attacks. But it seems to me, with creating quagmires and exactly what Mark just said there, is that it's putting into focus and targeting Iran, because, and it's doing it at the behest of Israel, mostly, probably Saudi Arabia as well. Go ahead, Joshua.
Well, this is absolutely true, and I think what Mark said was right. You should be careful what you wish for in a situation like this, because turning Syria into a quagmire is terrible for the neighbors. We see Iraq with widespread protests, now sanctions on Iran, and Syria has fallen into a state of complete anarchy, almost complete anarchy. If the rebels had taken over, of which there were hundreds of rebel militias, many of which were linked to al-Qaeda or other jihadist groups, and were destined to take over and were the strongest groups. The United States is turning the Middle East into a quagmire for the world, and we're seeing this outpouring of refugees that are going to Italy, going to various places in Europe, and causing all kinds of damage. And Middle Easterners getting angrier and angrier, which feeds the engines of extremists. This is not good for the world. It's not good for the United States. And here, you know, the hypocrisy meter, I must say, hits a high note, because when the United States attacked Mosul, the second largest city in Iraq, and attacked Raqqa, the world asked it to delay its attacks because there were so many civilians. The United States said, no, we have to destroy these terrorists, and laid waste to both cities. Yeah. I think 85% of the housing stock is now completely destroyed. Yeah. And you know, when Syria tries to do something similar, they raise a hue and cry and say, no, humanitarian issues must come first. And it's true. Yeah. Idlib presents a terrible humanitarian dilemma, but all the more reason why Russia and the United States should work together to pinpoint the al-Qaeda groups and destroy them.
Well, that's what Russia's been saying repeatedly, all right, repeatedly. Abdel, let me go to you. Just to kind of reflect upon what Joshua just said, you have to remember, this is what we're told in the mainstream media, is that we, the United States, accidentally hit hospitals, the Russians target them. That is a narrative that is thrown out there. One of the interesting things I find fascinating here, if I could just stay with Syria, but really focusing on Iran, is it really worth it? Now, November's coming up. We see this whole new sanction regime going against European companies and countries for any kind of trade, particularly oil trade with Iran. I mean, these economies in Europe, they still have austerity. The U.S. economy looks to be taking off. If there is a crisis in the energy markets, it's all bets off for everybody. Is it really worth it? Go ahead, Abdel in London.
No, it doesn't worth it at all, because if the American actually administration imposed an embargo against the oil, the Iranian oil export, the Iranian actually will be provoked. You know, look what happened in Gaza, for example. People turned to the border, the Israeli border, and there was a huge trouble. Look at the situation in Syria, for example. You know, so why we, you know, President Trump is fond of sanction after sanction. So if the Iranian block Hormuz Strait, for example, if they blocked the Bab el-Mandeb Strait again, and to say, you know, creating a huge havoc, chaos for the naval trade all over the world, what will happen to the European economy? What will happen to the American economy? And if the American actually impose this sanction against Iran, who will fill the vacuum? Russia and China and India. So this is the problem. Yeah, I believe President Trump is dragging the whole world into the brink of a war, a huge economic war that could be developed to actually all over war. this or a third world war. This is the danger which we are sensing in the Middle East. You know, I believe Donald Trump actually is going to, pushing everybody to the brink of a, you know, open war. So you know, it is extremely dangerous
It can really be summed up as the law of unintended consequences. Like sometimes I think I need to rename this program that, because that's the phrase I've been using for the last 10 years. Gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Trump's foreign policy on Sirius. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, let me go to Mark in Oxford. We're going to kind of spread this out a little bit here. You know, Mark, when, you know, it's kind of look at the Trumpian world here. I kind of get what he wants to do with North Korea. A step towards demilitarization, denuclearization is a good step, okay? And I see his own administration trying to slow that process down, okay? Then I look at, you know, NATO. I mean, before the election and after the election, Trump just doesn't really like NATO. I get it. I agree. That's a good idea, all right? He wants to have good relations with Russia. He's being blocked there as well. And I think he's taken the right initiative on new trade agreements without going to the extent of creating an all-out trade war, but I think some adjustments need to be. I get all of those things. I don't get his Middle East policy at all. At all. But, and I mean, and if you go back to his tweets and things like that, he's definitely under the influence of some people around him, because all the rest of it kind of fits into kind of a Trumpian paradigm, not the Middle East. Go ahead, Mark.
Well, I think there's the danger of making Trump into the bogeyman, because in fact, in many of the areas where his policies stir up alarm around the world, including among his allies, it's actually where he's representing the consensus inside the Washington Beltway. It's those areas where he stepped outside, like trying to find a settlement with North Korea, or for that matter, his reaching out to Putin, where he's been regarded as destabilizing. So the question is, is Trump a person with a clear agenda that he's having to steer through the political system in Washington, through the Congress, through the State Department and the CIA and so on? Or is it that he's perhaps a rather capricious person so that, for instance, we see that he showed great concern about civilian and particularly child casualties in Syria, but shows no interest at all in Yemen, for instance,
yeah,
and so on. That when his side, the Saudis, are doing it, it's okay, but when it's the people that he doesn't like, then it's wicked. So there's an element where I'm afraid Donald Trump is a highly personalized president and not really an apparatchik of the system. And that makes it rather difficult, because ultimately he is the decision maker. And we don't know how he will react to, for instance, a government offensive in Idlib, which, however calculated it may be, is almost certain to call civilian casualties, because there are so many civilians trapped in the area controlled by the jihadi rebels. We do know that he has in the past been easily emoted by being shown pictures and other evidence of suffering. And so there's a risk that he could therefore decide to be aggressive. And then he's backed in that by those groups in the American establishment, what I would call the unilateralist establishment, who want to assert US power and influence, including by showing who is military top dog, that could lead to some kind of attack on Syria that could draw in the Russians because of anti-aircraft forces and so on. And so there is a risk here that shouldn't be downplayed. It's something which rational people would want to avoid. But we have to be careful that once pride gets involved,
yep,
that people then decide they've got to show who is top.
Yeah, that was August 1914, for sure. Joshua, there seems to have been, Trump seems to have outsourced a lot of policy to the Israelis and the Saudis. I mean, unilaterally moving the embassy to Jerusalem, now just pretending that Palestinians don't even exist. They're not refugees anymore. Just crossing them off. I mean, is this a concerted policy, part of the grand peace process that we're going to probably all learn about in a few weeks' time? I mean, again, you know, what is the ultimate primary geostrategic goal of the United States looking at Syria, for example? Go ahead.
Well, I think it is driven by domestic politics, which is the underlining thing here. During his campaign, President Trump actually made very logical criticisms of Clinton's and Obama's policy and of George Bush's policy. He said Iraq had turned into the Harvard of jihadism and that it was stupid to go in there in 2003. He was absolutely correct. He said Afghanistan had gone on for too long. He was correct. Libya was a mess, that regime change was a stupid policy. And all of those, you know, turned out to be correct. And I think they really caught the American public's imagination.
Yep.
And people hoped that he would withdraw from the Middle East and stop these stupid wars, as he said. The trouble is that once he got into office, the machinery of Washington kicks in and he begins to have to play the playbook. And he believed, I think, that by following the money and following our friends, Israel, Saudi Arabia, that he would be making smart policy for the Middle East. But in fact, he fell into the same pattern that George Bush and others had fallen into, making stupid decisions, staying in there, trying to overthrow Iran's government, trying to push for change in Syria, you know, going along with Saudi Arabia in Yemen. All of these things have turned out to be bad moves. And in a sense, he thought he could make a deal with Saudi Arabia, Israel. I'll give Israel Jerusalem, and Israel will support Saudi Arabia against, Saudi Arabia will support Israel against Iran, and we can get Israel and Saudi Arabia to work together with the United States and clear up all these problems. And so he just began throwing candy at Israel and throwing candy at Saudi Arabia and taking down the Iran deal. And he thought that would be good for business, and it probably has been good for American business.
Yeah, but I mean, well, it's great for the arms producers. There's no doubt about that. Abdel, let me go back to you in London. I forgot to mention the Iran nuclear deal, and I think in history will show that withdrawing from it was world historically mistaken. Why? Because any kind of deal, under any circumstances, even through surrogates through Israel and Saudi Arabia, which I think is quite mindless to think that those two countries are going to be able to remake the Middle East. I mean, they're the last two in my mind. But, you know, why would anyone trust a brokered deal by this administration? I mean, it's really hard to comprehend why anyone would want to sign a piece of paper with an administration that walked away from an international agreement that was actually working. Go ahead, in London.
Well, I'm really surprised by, you know, how American president, the president of the free world, who negotiated, or his country negotiated with another five superpower in order to reach this nuclear deal with Iran, which actually put a halt to a nuclear race in the Middle East and created a lot of stability in that part of the world. So suddenly he said, I don't respect my signature. I want to pull out from this deal, and starting actually mobilizing Saudi Arabia and Israel for a war against Iran, to topple the regime there, to change the regime, and, you know, to rely on the two most unpopular regimes in the Middle East, which indulge in war. Saudi Arabia indulge in a war in Yemen, Israel indulge in a war in Gaza, and maybe South Lebanon soon, and indirectly in Syria. So I don't know why he is actually siding with the war-mongering countries in that part of the world. And when he criticized Obama, for example, I believe Obama administration was extremely wise. They want to pull out their troops from Afghanistan. They pulled out their troops from Iraq. They tried to reach a deal with Iran in order to avoid a war. Here we are with a president who actually war-mongering and listening to the people who are extremely unpopular, and they would like actually to take revenge from Iran, take revenge from Syria, take revenge from Iraq. We don't know, honestly. And when we talk about tens of thousands of people, I don't know, President Trump has forgotten completely that America killed more than 1 million people in Iraq. 1 million people, another 1 million under the sanction, which lasted 12 years. And we don't know until now how many people, how many civilians were killed in Libya, for example. How many civilians were killed in Mosul when the American bombed it? How many civilians were killed in Raqqa when the American F-16 bombed it? This is the problem. We have to raise our voice and to say, hang on, we have enough wars in the Middle East.
But the interesting thing, enough wars and enough stupid wars, I think that was Obama's phrase. Mark, yeah. I mean, the thing is that it's, you know, trying to explain this to me, speak slow so I can understand it. You know, when dealing with Syria, it's not Saudi Arabia that's going to involve itself militarily. It's not going to be Israel, obviously, even though they snipe at infrastructure and they try to blame it all on the Iranians. It's going to be the Americans that always do it. And the Americans are the ones that least benefit from it from every single dimension you could possibly imagine. But they still do it. Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, well, I think this is where we have to say that I think, as far as one can see, American public opinion, and I think also opinion in the American military from the odd U.S. service person I've been talking to recently, is very hostile to getting drawn into a real war, either in Syria or certainly with Iran. There's a recognition that that would be a serious conflict. So far, Trump has basically waged air wars using bombers and drone strikes. But a war with Iran would require ground forces. We can see the Saudi army cannot defeat the Houthi rebels, ragtag rebels. The idea that it could defeat the Iranian army and also many of the Shiite militias who would join it is therefore highly improbable. So as you say, if there's going to be a war of that sort with Iran, it's going to draw in the American ground forces. And that would be deeply unpopular. Yes, there might be a surge of patriotism at the beginning if it could be presented that the Iranians are attacking. But I suspect it could wreck not only the whole Trumpian project, but also cause deep divisions in US society because of the sense that Americans are dying for causes which are not only somebody else's, but are incomprehensible.
Yeah, given the track record, I'm going to give the last minute to Joshua. Joshua, going back to Trump and the art of the deal, is this all this saber rattling a bluff? Is it part of his game plan? Because if it is, it's a really risky game. People don't take it as a bluff always when you have a huge armada in the Mediterranean and you've already had hundreds of thousands of deaths in Syria. This is real. Is it? It's not a bluff. Go ahead, Joshua.
You know, I hate to differ with you, Peter, but I think that it is a bit of a bluff on Idlib. I don't think the United States believes that it's a win-win for it. If Syria goes in and kills all these al-Qaeda guys and jihadists, America will be grateful. They don't want the big humanitarian crisis, so they can decry it in advance. Then if it happens, they'll say we stood on the side of angels. But for America, in a sense, this is turning Syria into a quagmire.
Yep,
sure for is. Russia, for Iran, for its enemies. And America seems to think that that's smart policy. In the end, it's going to come back and bite.
Absolutely. And I agree with you completely on that. Gentlemen, we've run out of time. Many thanks to my guests in Norman, Oxford, and in London. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.